Last week, in the wake of Robin Williams' suicide, UpToDate discussed depression and the impact it can have over the course of a lifetime. Williams, who also dealt with substance abuse throughout his career, ended his life at age 63. Today, we approach depression again and how it touches a younger demographic, teenagers. Returning to help us with the topic is Dr. Wes Crenshaw, a board-certified family psychologist in Lawrence and now in Prairie Village. Dr. Wes is the author of I Always Want to Be Where I'm Not, Successful Living with ADD and ADHD. Joining him is Fiona, a Free State High School sophomore who writes a blog in which she's discussed her own struggles with depression. Thanks to both of you for coming on the show.
Nice to be here.
Yep.
So, Wes, first off, we should note that we had planned this discussion well before the news of Robin Williams broke last week. You know, the issue of depression in teens is an important topic that we want to touch on.
Yeah, it's really serendipity that we, Fiona and I, had already talked and had pitched this for our show this month. And then the Robin Williams situation happened. And I think there are a couple of really important things about that to point out in the context of today's discussion. The first is, I know Robin Williams because I'm old. I remember him back from Mork and Mindy and then a great performance in Good Will Hunting as the psychologist. And so kids today know him very well as the guy in Jumanji and some other shows that they're very familiar with. I did not fully understand that until you see Twitter blow up with this right now. And kids are very moved and devastated by this, as are we as adults. The second thing to understand that we were going to talk about anyhow, and I guess it's worth talking about here, people who are depressed, who by the diagnostic manual have major depressive disorder or one of the what are called unipolar depressions, are actually not at a very high risk of suicide. It's the people who have bipolar disorder who are at the high risk. And you look, and not that I'm here to diagnose Robin Williams, but if you ever watch him and follow his creative energy, it's very manic. And he struggled, I think, probably with a bipolar illness. And so we'll talk a little more about how that's different later on, but that's where the big risk factor is for suicide.
Well, according to the National Institute of Mental Health, 11% of teens have been diagnosed with a depressive disorder by the time they're 18. But you've said, if there's one thing I've learned over the years, real clinical depression is among the most difficult disorders to assess in children and teens. Why is it so hard to figure this out with that age group?
Well, there's a couple reasons. The first of them we kind of alluded to, and that is there's many different presentations of different diagnoses for kids. And depression, in my experience, has very often secondary to another kind of a problem, whether it is ADD or anxiety or bipolar disorder. And so you'll see people, let's say in the ADD example, feeling really depressed about being ADD, about not being connected in the same way cognitively to the world that their peers are. And that makes them feel bad. Or when you're anxious, when you're worried all the time, you wake up every day fearful that something really bad will happen and you can't differentiate the risk in those situations, that's depressing. So there's a sorting that out from the regular just singular depression is tricky. And then kids are in a state of great upheaval in adolescence, and figuring out which ones are actually depressed versus just having a down period is tricky.
So then what are the signs of depression in teens, and how do they differ from, you know, those signs in adults?
Well, you have your standards that we see with adults: loss of interest in activities, feeling that your life has no meaning, having what we call self-deprecating behavior, looking down upon yourself, having an extremely negative self-esteem, poor performance in school, appetite changes up or down. And, you know, the problem is if you're thinking about that list, it applies to a lot of things. Any kid can go through one or two of those. But when they are persistent over the course of time, or they impair the young person so much over weeks or months, then you start looking at a clinical depression. And you also have to realize that with kids, that may not present as obviously as I just described. You'll instead see it show up as, you know, irritability or the sort of excessively negative bad mood that you see sometimes.
So a lot of those symptoms that you just mentioned, they seem almost common, particularly in those teenage years. You know, is it kind of this persistence and the kind of length of time or the depth to which these symptoms go that might be part of a clue?
It is. And the other catch in the whole thing is that because they are 14 and 15 years old, they don't have the life experience that we have to express subjectively how this is different than, say, 5 years ago. They may just feel more down, and being able to tell whether that's depression or not, they don't necessarily have as much life experience. And because they're not as communicative with us sometimes as teenagers, they don't respond like, hey, look at me, I'm depressed. They act out. Maybe they do some negative behaviors, drinking, criminal activity, et cetera, that we interpret as antisocial kind of behaviors when, in fact, there's an underlying depression there.
You're listening to Up to Date on KCUR and our discussion of depression in teens with Dr. Wes Crenshaw. We'd like to hear from other young people who have experience with depression, so tell us how you're dealing with it at 816-235-2888. I want to bring in our other guest here. Fiona, you write very honestly and openly about your struggle with depression, and it's truthfully very, very moving to read. So I want to thank you first for sharing your story.
I'm glad to share it.
And thanks for being here. So, Fiona, can you kind of help us understand, what did you first notice personally when you began feeling depressed?
I was just down, and I started not wanting to do many things. I was isolating myself from friends. But when I was with them, I didn't enjoy being around them because I couldn't tell them what was going on with me. I didn't want to talk to any of them. In general, I was just down. I didn't want to go to school. I lost interest in some things like running and stuff, which has been a big part for me for a while. I just like that wasn't something I wanted to do as much. Schoolwork wise, I kept doing my schoolwork and stuff because I knew I needed to, but I didn't want to do it. And it just wasn't what it used to be for me.
So when you were going through it, did you have this feeling that some of this was kind of more serious than just the normal ups and downs, as we were talking about with Wes earlier?
Yeah, it kept going on. I was constantly down. It wasn't one of those things where I'd be down like one day and then I'd be fine. It was just constantly I felt bad. And really, I started kind of getting into like self-harming stuff. And that's when I knew like it was much worse than just being upset about something.
So, Fiona, you mentioned self-harming, and on your blog you talked that you started cutting as part of your depression. Can you explain what that is for our listeners and kind of give us a clue into that?
I mean, self-harm is just cutting yourself. I really probably won't go into details on that,
sure,
but
yeah.
I mean, for me, it was just like a razor or something. But self-harm kind of encompasses a lot of things. It can be like some people burn themselves.
Let me ask Wes about that. You know, is this common, Wes, for depressed teens to cut or to do self-harm?
Well, it's not as common just for the depressed kids. Cutting is a unique problem, and it isn't uncommon in general, but I know kids who aren't depressed who cut. And cutting is a little more like anorexia, believe it or not. It's the thought process that goes with it is similar. And what happens is it's a person's inability to cope with or solve problems in their life. They feel very impotent in being able to change things. And they often will have family members who are very high achievers. And it's not so much it's not the family who says, you need to get an A. It's the family where that's just understood. It's kind of under the radar. And the kids tend to be fairly anxious. And so they want to please. They want to do the right thing by family and society. And the inability to be perfect in that regard, the inability to do that as well as they would like to, creates this sort of inner turmoil, this sort of explosive inner turmoil. And they tend, because they can't lash out at others because they're nice, they turn on themselves. And so that goes along with it. You know, if you think about what I just described, it's kind of depressing. So that kind of goes along with the depression, but they tend to be a little separate from each other.
So, Wes, if this discussion is resonating with some people and they think they might want to reach out, you know, what's an example? There's no playbook, but what's a first step that someone might be able to take to kind of start help themselves and start getting treatment?
Yeah, that's such a good question. So there's a broad range of treatments, but one wants to sort of start with what we refer to as the least restrictive environment or the easiest solution. And I think there are two ways that usually plays out. And the first one is you do what seems logical, which is you talk to your kid and the kid feels depressed and you head to the family physician and they give you I'll lay bets that they either give you Lexapro or Zoloft. That's what's in there. Fiona's nodding right now. She knows of what we speak. And there's nothing wrong with that except that every national association for kids in psychology and psychiatry and everything agrees that medication management needs to go hand in hand with a psychotherapy process. So I generally don't recommend doing that, and not just because I need more clients, because believe me, I'm pretty busy right now. Why I recommend you go to a psychologist or clinical social worker or marriage and family therapist or counselor and first sit down for two or three sessions and talk about what's going on with the child, a young person. Talk about this with the family. Talk privately with the kid. Kids really generally like to open up when they feel like someone is listening, who knows how to listen and talk about these things. And that's the first step. And maybe medication won't be necessary, and maybe it will, but the first step is really getting a good sense of what's going on for the young person.
Fiona, I was reading on your blog about how you kind of found the strength to be able to talk to someone, and that was kind of the first step. Do you, looking back on it, do you have any kind of tips of what worked for you in reaching out to someone, or what that process was like?
For me, I just went to someone I trusted very well, and that happened to be my cross-country coach, because I had known him for like the last 2 years, and I knew that he would probably handle it well, and he did. And so, I don't know, for me, that was just... You just kind of have to do it. Like, I knew I needed to tell someone because I just knew that I shouldn't be doing – I didn't want to cut and stuff. So, but it can be kind of nerve-wracking to go forward and, like, talk to someone. But it's really the best thing you can do for yourself.
So, Wes, let's talk a little bit about treatment. What is the first step in getting treatment for this kind of thing?
Well, kind of like – excuse me. Like I described, getting the good diagnosis down. And then you have really – you've got to do an assessment of how serious the situation is. And I can't say enough about why you want to get that right. You know, every week, this is what I have to do, is sit there and think, okay, are we responding too harshly, or that's not a very good word for it, are we responding, taking this more seriously and then making the situation worse by over-responding, or are we under-responding? Are we not offering enough treatment or enough time with the kid or enough recommendations for medicine? So that's the first thing the parent really has to do, is to sit down and figure out what's going to be the necessity here for treatment. And there are really three options, and we probably have plenty to discuss about each one. The first is outpatient therapy, and that is exactly what you see on Goodwill Hunting. To go back and use that example, you see the therapist and the client sitting down talking together. For teenagers, that necessarily includes some relationship with the family, and that can be kind of a tricky negotiation for some people, because there are the therapists who won't ever talk to the family, and that just isn't a good way to handle teenagers. And there is the therapist who will never talk to the teenager alone, and that isn't a good way to handle it. So you have to have kind of a negotiation about what will be shared, and that usually is things about imminent risk, and what won't be shared, which are things that are usually personal and about the young person's life that they really want to keep private. And that will, in the majority of cases, take care of the issue. And that may include a medication referral, but that therapy intervention will usually be sufficient for treatment.
So how does hospitalization play a role in that? I mean, could that be a step that you might want to take?
Well, that is the most extreme response. And by all means, I have been involved in hospitalizing kids. So I'll say that up front before I say it's the last resort. Usually what will happen, and there's a screening process that goes on for that, that is in part to justify the use of health insurance for providing what's a very expensive intervention, and in part to determine whether a diversion can be had, and diversion would be back to outpatient therapy, or I'll talk in a little bit about intensive outpatient, which is the next step up. But hospitalization is reserved for people who are at fairly imminent risk of self-harm, and I don't mean the cutting that Fiona described, something that's very lethal. Most cutters, and I think Fiona will agree, are not attempting to commit suicide. The research is very clear on that. So there's a difference in cutting your wrists versus cutting on your belly or your leg or something to induce that endorphin release that you get from cutting. So you really assess that and determine, is this person at a lethal risk? And if they will not contract to prevent self-harm and to engage in outpatient or intensive outpatient therapy, that's when hospitalization becomes important.
So after this assessment, what's next then? Therapy, medication, a combination of the two?
Well, the combination is frequent. I still hold to the old standard about this, and it's changed some, and there's probably a worthy debate about why it's changed. But the old assessment was that National Institutes of Mental Health recommended that you do 7 to 10 therapy sessions before making a medication referral. I don't know whether 7 to 10 is a magic number, but it strikes me that a few sessions to get a baseline on the young person and to see if you can make that change with talk therapy is worth doing, because once you go to medication, for it to be effective, you're committing to several months worth of treatment. So I still like that model. Now, in between the outpatient and the inpatient is a relatively new thing called intensive outpatient. And we make referrals for that. I'm in the same office with Dr. Davila in Awakenings here in Prairie Village and also in Lawrence. And we make our referrals to her. And what they do that's different is they would see someone several times a week for several hours for a shorter period of time, 4 to 6 weeks. This, to me, is really the way to avoid unnecessary hospitalization for teens who can't just be managed with outpatient therapy alone.
You know, this is a good chance. Let's take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll continue our discussion with Dr. Wes Crenshaw. I'm Jeremy Bernfeld, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. Right now, we're talking about depression in teens with Dr. Wes Crenshaw, who is a board-certified psychiatrist. Psychologist. Got it right the first time. As well as Fiona, who's a Free State High School sophomore. Fiona, I'd love to get to you for a quick second. You've written about being stigmatized because of struggles with depression.
Yes.
What's that like, and how have you dealt with that?
It makes me very mad when people stigmatize me. Even people close to me, they do it kind of unconsciously. I know they don't mean to, but they'll act a certain way or blame me for what's going on and say that, like, I'm putting it all on them, which is never the case. Like, that's not what I'm trying to do, but they will tell me that, and it's just frustrating because also sometimes it just shows that they really don't understand the illness and what depression is. And they'll tell me that I can control what's going on in my head, but that's just not how it works with depression sometimes. And so that's very frustrating.
If you are a parent of a young person with depression, tell us how you became aware of it. You can call us. Our number is 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Wes, before the break, we were talking about some of the treatment, and you noted the need for intensive outpatient work. So how intensive are we talking here?
Well, it's a little like going to the hospital without going to the hospital. You're in there for several days during the week. They do one of the really helpful things in using intensive outpatient for this kind of treatment is that if you go to the hospital, you're going to be in there for just a few days. So they go at you with a bunch of medicine, and then they don't really have a follow-up. Their goal is to keep you alive and operating. With intensive outpatient, you go in and you're there for several weeks, and so they can follow up on the medication management and then make a referral to an outpatient therapist. And so used sort of as an adjunct to regular outpatient therapy for people who cannot just be managed on that weekly or twice a month basis, it's pretty helpful, and it gives the eyes on of a psychiatrist without having to have the actual inpatient expense and the inpatient upset. It's not really fun at all for teenagers to be hospitalized. And the very small number who come out liking it, you worry about, because it means they're adapting to a hospital setting that's probably not that great for them.
Fiona, can you describe a little bit about what your treatment included?
For me, I basically just saw my therapist about once a week. When I would start to get better, sometimes we would space out those sessions for like 2 or 3 weeks, which wasn't always the best idea, because in that time, then I would kind of get off balance again, and then we'd have to pick things back up. But I also take Lexapro and Nortriptyline. But I took those before I got depressed, I had really bad headaches because of anxiety. But those are like antidepressants and anti-anxiety medications. And when I started having problems, I went to the doctor, my family physician, and he upped my doses more to kind of help cover things.
To our listeners out there, you can join the conversation at 816-235-2888. I'll bring in a caller now. Let's bring in Barbara. Hi, Barbara. Oh, Barbara?
Yes.
Oh, hi, Barbara. There you go. Do you have a question here for Wes or for Fiona?
I do. I like to get their perspective or the doctor's perspective on TMS and the promise that it has for, you know, people that are depressed and other probably mental health issues. And I know Dr. Davila is probably one of the only physicians in the area that does TMS.
Great.
And
well, Barbara, let me throw that to Wes, and we can follow up on.
Can we anticipate this being used more on adolescents?
Okay, great. So, Wes, we're talking here about TMS. Can you tell us what that is and how it's used?
It is. I don't know that I can pronounce all of its initials, but it's transcranial magnetic stimulation, I think is the correct acronym. And it is kind of an interesting thing. I first learned about this probably, 8 years ago. I went to a seminar on bipolar disorder, and they had this strange finding in their research. They were doing this magnetic resonance scanning of people with bipolar disorders' brains, because they were trying to figure out, you know, different things about how the brain fires in those situations. And unexpectedly, the people started getting better who were going through this process. And so at that time, they were now changing over to seeing whether using magnetic resonance scanning would cause improvement. Well, over the course of time, the FDA recently approved a version of this, which is the TMS. And, you know, it's kind of an interesting thing. You wear this kind of hat thing, and they have to very carefully measure out and set up where this is going to go in the brain. It's not like ECT, electroconvulsive therapy. It doesn't have any of those side effects that go along with it, but then they direct this magnetic energy into the brain. And you do multiple treatments of this. And right now, I think it's still up in the air as to whether health insurance is going to cover that, but it is an FDA-approved treatment. And it's off-label use for teenagers, like everything is. Teenagers are off-label for most things, but physicians can prescribe it. And there are three of those in town. One of them's at St. Luke's, and the caller's right. One of them is in Dr. Davila's office. And there's a third one somewhere like in Lee Summit or something like that. And these are particularly helpful for people who have tried medication and it just isn't getting it for them, and it seems to have great promise.
Thanks, Barbara. Thanks for the call on TMS.
Thank you.
Let's bring in another caller. We have here Marianne from Overland Park. Hi, Marianne.
Hi, how are you? I just wanted to talk briefly about what parents should be not doing when they have a child that's exhibiting moodiness and...
We're getting nods around the room here from Wes and Fiona.
I'm sorry?
We're getting nods around the room here from Wes and Fiona, but please continue.
Yeah, I'm an adult now. I'm 68 years old. I'm still suffering from severe depression, and a lot of my symptoms go back to my feelings of low self-worth, because my parents were constantly critical, constantly calling me names and saying I was like my Grandma Hughes and what's wrong with you and all kinds of things that I have carried with me throughout my adult life. And I think that's one of the reasons I'm still in treatment and still taking medication for depression, because I have such a low self-worth. And I'm just saying, parents, take a look at your children and make sure you do everything you can to help them rather than be critical.
Great. Well, thanks, Marianne. So Wes, are there things that stand out as what should parents not do if they are kind of just thinking that maybe their teen needs some help?
Now, this show goes on for 3 days, right, Jeremy?
Yeah, that's right. We have time.
Yeah, there's plenty to talk about. Okay, so there are kind of two things I'd like to respond to in that. The first thing is, when you have a child that you believe may have depression, and I too am interested in what Fiona has to say about this, you want to not try to talk them out of it. You want to, if you have an anxious child, for example, you want to think about how to approach them to lower their anxiety. And too often, if an anxious child is feeling depressed, parents respond with an anxious response, and this just scares the child more. And if you have a child who needs to be kind of pushed a little harder, even if they're depressed, sometimes the parent does have to set more structure for what's going on. But you have to make a response that's very calm. The second thing that the caller is talking about is parents who are really sort of depressionogenic, if you will. They create a depressive environment, and that does exist. Now, in fairness, we do understand that many people have depression that are not influenced as that caller described. And we have two kinds of depression. There's exogenous depression and endogenous depression. And exogenous means external factors like the caller described. And endogenous means that you have a strong predisposition for depression. Now, listeners probably think, well, couldn't those go together? They absolutely can. And so if you're very resilient, very low depression, and you go off to Iraq and see your friends blown up, you have a much higher chance of becoming depressed, even though you're not predisposed. And if you have a high predisposition, it may take very little. A dark day outside or losing a friend breaks off a relationship with you to push you into the throes of depression. So those two things work interactively.
Thanks, Marianne. That's a very important point. Fiona, you were nodding when Marianne called in with that point that there are certain things that parents and others should not do when they're worried about depression. I'm wondering if there was anything in your experience that was particularly helpful or particularly unhelpful that a friend or a parent or a coach or a doctor, did within your treatment.
I think with parents, they have a tendency to want to blame themselves for what happened, and not necessarily. It usually probably isn't their fault what's going on, and so. I don't think parents should blame themselves for it, because that'll just make everyone feel worse. But with your kid, they may not want to talk to you about what's going on. They may prefer to talk to like a professional, and I don't think you should push them to talk about it if they don't want to, because then at least with me, I was very uncomfortable talking about it with my parents. I preferred to talk to my therapist about things. And just by pushing me and trying to get me to talk about it made it worse. My mom at one point asked, when she first found out I was having problems, if she could see my cuts, which was not something I wanted to do, and that made me very uncomfortable. Also, if they sometimes will act like, oh, I don't know who you are anymore, like what happened, but that's just not a really fair thing to say, because it's depression and it's
inside.
It's
a good example of an anxiety reaction. You'll notice both of the ones that Fiona described, I must be a terrible parent or it's my fault. That's an anxiety reaction. And I just don't know you anymore is an anxiety reaction. And that raised your anxiety, didn't it? Makes it worse in that situation. And you just have to, one must balance out the seriousness of this situation with a calm response. It's like if you see your little child on the playground tip over and start crying. You have two choices at that moment. You jump up and run madly across the playground, scream, "Oh my God, are you okay?" Or you get up and walk slowly. You're going to get there in just the same time. And you calmly say, "Let's get up and sit down and for a little while." The same reaction to an experience of worry about depression or cutting or anything, you've got to be calm in the response. And parents often trip over that one.
And Fiona, what about something that might be particularly helpful? And maybe this was a personal experience or maybe not. But if someone were to have a friend, say, or someone they worked with or something like that, kind of say, "I think I'm looking for some help." Is there anything that you think might be particularly helpful or that was particularly helpful for you?
Just be open and let them talk to you. Don't push them to do anything, but just make sure they know, like, you're going to be there and stuff. And really don't stigmatize them. Don't blame them for what's going on, because as soon as you do that, they're not going to want to talk to you.
Wes, is there any follow-up on that? You know, if someone were to come to me and say, "I think I'd like some help," what should I do?
Well, I think that, suggesting therapy is a good idea, because if a peer suggests it, it seems like it's an okay thing to do. And I think we've come a long, long way in the last 10 or 15 years with this. I do agree with Fiona that there still can be stigma attached, but young people routinely refer their friends to the point where it gets to be a problem. You can't see everybody's friends. It gets to be too much of a conflict of interest sometimes. Families will refer friends. It's become less of a stigma. And I think we need to encourage people to see it that way. I get a little frustrated, particularly with ADD, but to some degree with depression, that there's this sort of movement now to say, the pharmaceutical industry is just tricking you into thinking you have ADD or depression. Q did a show the other night on this very issue, and they went out of their way to complain that, it's just the pharmaceutical industry is tricking us all. Well, it's not. And when you say things like that, it goes back to stigmatizing people, that if you all just get up and do what needs to be done, you wouldn't have this problem. And I think that was a little bit of what Fiona was talking about earlier. So I think when someone comes to you and wants to talk to you about it, it's important to listen and be supportive. Fiona gives a great example in her blog of how a friend that was not even a close friend was there for her at a very critical moment. And I think young people can really make a huge difference with people around them by being supportive in those situations.
Fiona, can you tell us a little bit about what that friend did or how that worked as you did in your blog?
Well, I run cross country, and so I know a lot of people from that. And I had an older friend. She was a senior when I was a sophomore. And there was a particular night where I really wanted to cut, and I hadn't for about a month. And so I texted her, and she came over and, like, sat with me and stuff and talked to me and just kind of got me through that moment. And that was, like, a turning point for me. Things, like, I started to reach out to more people and open up to other people rather than keep it all inside. And so that really helped me.
This is Up to Date on KCUR and KCUR.org. Today we're talking depression in teens with Dr. Wes Crenshaw and a young woman dealing with the illness, Fiona. If you're the parent of a young person with depression, tell us how you became aware of it. Our number is 816-235-2888. If you're a teen dealing with depression, you can call us, you can tweet us how you're coping with it, at KCUR Up to Date. Wes, you were talking a little bit about medications. And a few years ago, the Food and Drug Administration adopted what's called a black box warning on antidepressants. That's the most serious kind of warning label they put on medications. It indicated that some antidepressants may increase the risk of suicidal thinking in some children and adolescents. So what's the status of those black box warning about antidepressants?
Yeah, there's a great example of a hysterical response. So we'll all just remember, I'm not a medical doctor, but this is my stock and trade on a daily basis, is to talk with people in conjunction with medical doctors, so I do keep track of all this. So what happened was, on one of these SSRIs, I don't remember which one it was, there was in their trial, 2% of the control group of teenagers had an increase in suicidal thoughts. Now, that remember, the control group of the people taking a sugar pill. And then 4% of the people in the actual experimental group had an increase in suicidal thoughts, and nobody attempted or came close to attempting suicide. Well, this got into the media and around the country and got people freaked out, and there was this big movement. It was about 2004 or 2005, and the FDA black boxed him and said it could increase suicidal ideation. Now, have I run into that before? Yes, I have. I have seen it happen. In my experience, that has tended to be one of the diagnostic indicators of a bipolar disorder, or what we're now calling in teenagers as of October with the new DSM-5, disruptive mood dysregulation disorder, which is sort of a lower grade mood instability that may pass with adolescence. But what really happened during that time was when they black boxed it and prescribers freaked out and were very worried about prescribing these, the suicide rate went up. And so these medicines are far more likely on a moment-to-moment basis to decrease people's likelihood of self-harm than they are to increase it. That said, it's another good reason to have a therapist in these situations, because I will meet with people weekly or at the longest every 10 days or 2 weeks, and those are the kind of things they're going to tell me. They're going to say, I have these crazy thoughts. I'd never have wanted to hurt myself before, and now I'm having those thoughts. And we immediately get on the phone with the prescriber and make a change. So it's another good reason to be in a very careful team relationship, therapist, client, family, prescriber.
We got a comment on Twitter from someone named Kelsey. She says, it is possible to get treatment. I'm a success story. So Wes, I imagine, I mean, as we all know, there are certainly plenty of people who struggle with depression and plenty of people who get treatment and are able to you know, move on or to deal with that within treatment.
Yes. And the vast majority recover fully, are free of symptoms. There are people who will be struggling with this on and off because their predisposition is to become depressed when there are difficult and stressful situations. So they may go through this several times in life. But, yeah, people do well with treatment, and we know how to help them.
Fiona, is there anything that's been most helpful for you as you're recovering from depression, as you're getting treatment?
For me, what was really helpful for me was having an outlet. That was working out and, like, running for me. That's something that I've always loved to do. And so I did that every day, religiously, really, to the point where my family thought I almost had, like, an eating disorder because I was doing it so often, but it was really just a stress thing. Also, I had a really good support system. I had some friends. I didn't necessarily – we weren't very close, but that was something that I could rely on them for. And I had some, like, teachers at school and then my family.
And you really bring up a good point, Fiona, because as teenagers are complex creatures, everything that's good also has a potential for flaw. And I guarantee if I'd have been seeing you, I would have worried that you were having an exercise-related anorexia, given the context of the situation. But we recommend the exercise, just as she's describing, for people who are depressed, because it helps your body to be physiologically sound as in dealing with the depression. So you'd have been telling me, yeah, I'm out running every day. I'd be like, great. And then you start worrying, okay, is that becoming obsessive? Is it part of an anorexic condition? So this is why trying to eyeball it sometimes is really difficult. And you have to have a really good dialogue with the young person to understand, what does it mean to them to run every day? Is it a healthy thing? Is it getting on the borderline of a problem? And for you, it was great.
I'd like to bring in another caller. Let's bring in David from Independence. Hi, David.
Hi. My comment is, you just don't know when your child is going to commit suicide. There is no flags, at least in our case. My daughter was depressed. We had her on a medication regimen and psychologist to try and help her, and she just went, up and down and up and down. Everything was life catastrophic. She overdosed on Wellbutrin. And it was, we're eating dinner one minute, she's doing homework the next. The next thing I know, she's talking to her boyfriend on the phone. And the next thing I know, I think she's crying on the couch. And I come in, and she's foaming at the mouth, and she's taking all of her Wellbutrin tablets. you just don't know. I don't know how I can stress that enough, but you have to be on that just alert all the time.
Right.
If you have a child that is, you know, in those peaks and valleys so drastically, because medication and therapy, they help, but they aren't the be-all and all. You have to watch. You have to be vigilant.
Thank you so much for sharing that story, David. Wes, you were nodding your head along with David.
Yeah, David, I'm sorry for that struggle. I am intimately involved in those kinds of situations, and I feel it in my heart for you. He makes an absolutely critical point. A number of years ago, we reluctantly published a list of symptoms in our column of suicidality as are accepted in the field, and I have never done it again, and I won't ever do it again for two or three reasons, and David hit most of them. First of all, none of those symptoms predict a blame thing. They predict whether a person is, you know, depressed, or every one of those symptoms, with two exceptions I'll name in a second, are present in every condition of mental health. And it's sort of our desperate attempt to lay control onto something that's really uncontrollable when it comes to self-harm. The two exceptions you watch out for are fairly obvious ones. One is giving away all your possessions or giving things to people. And the other is telling people goodbye for no apparent reason. Now, you say, well, that's a little too obvious. That's what it takes. You start hearing that from somebody and you get worried. And I think the lists of symptoms that are promoted are hard for families like David's, who are not going to know a lot of the time. I do a lot of work with survivors of suicide, and by survivors I mean the people who lived around this person who committed suicide, both parents and children as the victims of self-harm. And nearly 100% of the time in those cases, no one saw it coming. The girlfriend didn't see it. The parent didn't see it. The child didn't see it. No one saw it coming. And so we have to forgive ourselves. We have to be forgiving when this happens and we didn't know, because you're usually not going to.
You know, we only have about a minute left, but I want to really stress that point. What are the risk factors for suicide in teens?
Well, the presence of a non-unipolar depression. If there's a history of bipolar depression in the family, if there is a history of suicidality in the family, the minute that door is opened, it's just like anything else. If the door gets opened, kids will be more prone to follow through and go through the door. If you see a lot of substance abuse, this, you know, it's hard nowadays because there's an awful lot of substance abuse amongst teens, but heavy substance abuse, and if the person gets into certain kinds of prescription pain medicines, or now we're seeing more heroin on the street for kids in any socioeconomic group, those are all higher risk factors for suicide.
Wes Crenshaw delivers the keynote address this Thursday, August 21st, at the Health and Spirituality Conference in Independence. It's at 7 p.m. It's free to the public, but advance reservations are required. So there's a link to that at our website, kcur.org. That's all the time that we have for today. Fiona is a sophomore at Free State High School in Lawrence. Fiona, thank you so much for speaking with me.
Yep, thank you for having me.
Read her blog. It's awesome.
And we'll have a link to that at kcur.org as well. It also is awesome. Dr. Wes Crenshaw is a board-certified family psychologist in Lawrence and in Prairie Village. Thank you, Wes, for coming on the show.
Good to be here, Jeremy.